You'll realize your dreams, you know, but it's just going to take you some time to get there.
This is the Insurance Technology Podcast, where we bring interesting people from across the insurance ecosystem to discuss and debate technology's impact on the industry. Join us each episode for insights and best practices from industry stewards and tomorrow's innovators. Now, here's your host, Reed Holdsworth.
Welcome to the Insurance Technology Podcast. I'm your host, Reed Holdsworth. In this episode, we're going to be interviewing Joe Stevenson. Joe is the Director of Digital Intelligence at Intertel. Now, Joe is a little bit different than other guests we've had in the past. Joe started off his career as a police officer in Maine. And hey, folks, let me tell you, I've never interviewed someone from law enforcement, but I've been interviewed many a time. But look, in all seriousness, we're going to get into Joe's transition from that to insurance. Then we're going to get into what Joe is doing now, which is really cool. Stay tuned. Really great episode. You're going to love it.
Joining me today is Joe Stevenson, Director of Digital Intelligence at Intertel. Joe, welcome. What an amazing title, I must say.
Hey, listen, when you get to make up your own title, you're going to spend some time on it.
I love it, man. I love it. So, Joe, we met recently and had a really great conversation. I think that this is going to be a really good one for the listeners. We're going to dive into a lot of topics about what you do now and your history. But before we do, love to know a little bit about yourself. So, Joe, tell us a little about yourself. Who was Joe growing up?
Who was Joe growing up? Well, you know, so... You know, grew up in rural Maine. So it was, you know, one of those things where you grew up fishing, you know, being outdoors quite a bit. But
like rural Maine, like what part of Maine? I feel like Maine's not that big. So is there like only one rural Maine?
No, Maine's actually pretty big. So I was in Poland Spring, where the water is named from. So grew up, you know, not on the lake, but not far away. Plenty of woods, you know,
awesome.
You know, not in the city. So, you know, the closest place nearby was a golf course where I eventually started working at when I was young. But, you know, you spend a lot of time just, you know, going fishing, hiking, you know, doing those things that, you know, a kid of the 80s did, or 70s and 80s, yeah. Right? I'm old enough to remember life before cell phones, CD players. you know, so it was one of those things. And I went to school, you know, 12, 13 miles away in the city. Which was probably only about 40,000 people at the time. And then school wasn't my thing. I wasn't a really good student, but I really enjoyed school. So student council, wasn't a jock, but played tennis, manager of the hockey team, drama, you name it, I was involved. If it kept me busy, active, I loved it. And that was it. You know, you'd go back to rural Maine in the afternoons or whatever, and, you know, do those things and, you know, just kind of hung out. Family wasn't super rich. You don't really know that at the time. You know, it's only later on that you learn what your parents struggled to get you through it, you know, to make your life better.
What was something difficult you dealt with as a child?
So, you know, I don't know that I really had any struggles, right? Or if you had struggles, you didn't know they were struggles. So, you know, my parents, you know, worked hard. They both ended up working later on. They sent me to private Catholic school, which, you know, kind of squandered that education. You know, made it through, but, you know, by the skin of my teeth. But, you know, I can remember my father getting laid off from a job. My mother used to talk about how we spent, you know, 2 or 3 months living off of, you know, the garden and peanut butter. I don't remember that. I still love peanut butter, so it couldn't have been too terrible or tormenting for me. You know, so, hey, you know, there's a lot of people that have struggled a lot more than I have in their life. You know, I think I've had a blessed life.
That's awesome, man. I met this woman not that long ago. She's actually an author. Randomly met this person, started chatting it up with her. And it was funny. She said that. She's like, I had the best life ever, Reed, growing up. And she's like, you know, as I've gotten older, I have this trauma of not having trauma.
I mean, you know, it's serious. It's you know, I guess you don't know what you don't know, right? Like that's so true, right? So I don't know any struggles. I guess we didn't have stuff, but you didn't have it to miss it. So how would you know that it was, you know, sure, there's other kids that had Ataris and three wheelers.
You didn't get the Atari.
I didn't get the Atari. I didn't get the three wheeler.
Yeah.
My father used to have a saying. He said, if you can see it on TV, you're not getting it for Christmas.
So, oh, that's awesome. Right? I'm going to use that. Too bad kids don't watch TV.
Right,
anymore.
Yeah. No. If you don't see it on TikTok, if you see it on TikTok, you're not getting it.
That's awesome, man. So, hey, when you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
So from my earliest times, I think I wanted to be an actor, comedian, you know. For me, it's that police aspect was always in there too. So, you know, growing up, Rockford Files, Chips, Simon and Simon, those were the shows that always captivated me. You know, I can remember my father used to watch MacMillan and Wife, you know, the PI stuff, Magnum PI and all that.
Those always resonated with me.
So, you know, I would say that in between there, maybe actor, police officer, mechanic were always the things that I kind of leaned towards. And as it was, one ended up being true. You know, I eventually became a police officer.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think that was probably the easier to obtain than the other two. I like playing around with cars, but I'm no mechanic. So I'm glad I didn't try to pick that profession.
So what about in high school? What'd you do after high school?
So after high school, I tried the college thing. It didn't stick. Didn't really have the money. You know, I think it was $20,000 a year at the time for college. And it wasn't something that I had to pay for it. My parents just certainly didn't have the means to do that. So, you try it, never got a degree. Not sure it really hasn't held me back. I think there's plenty of people in the history of the world and certainly, you know, in small business history that don't have degrees. I've gone back and taken classes where I felt that I wanted to take like a constitutional law class or something along those lines, but never a really finished degree. Didn't look at the military when I got out of high school. Tried to join later on, got medically disqualified in the 90s. So I'm glad I didn't try when I was in the 80s. One day you're just sitting there and you're going, okay, college isn't working out. I guess start thinking long term here. You know, what am I going to do with my life? And I always wanted to be a cop.
Yeah.
Let's go try to be a cop.
So tell us about that. Tell us about being a cop. You're the first cop that I've interviewed. Geez. I mean, I've been interviewed by lots of police officers over the years. Let's be real.
But they're the ones asking the questions.
100%. Yeah.
It was an interesting thing. It's one of those funny things where you're 19 and you're like, what am I going to do? And you're like, oh, I'm going to become a cop. Well, how do you become a cop? I don't know. I'm just going to go to the police station, knock on the door and say, hey, I want to be a cop. And surprisingly enough, it worked, right? They're like, oh, come on in. You know, and yeah, at the time
really though, you like went there and you're like, hey, I want to work here. What do I need to do? And they're like, the cop at the front's like, hey, let me
get one of the detectives. And they bring you around, they showed you everything. And they're like, okay, so this is what you have to do. You got to do this. You got to do that. You got to go to this school. You got to, go to the academy eventually. And they laid it all out. You're like, okay, what's my first step? And, that was it. And, you're showing interest, you're following up with them. And then it was like, hey, we've got this part-time job and dispatch. Do you want to try that? Sure. If it gets me in the door, starts teaching me the network, right? That's where I started to realize at a young age, networking was so vital. Because once you got in that door, right, and things started opening up and you started to have opportunities, you showed your worth, then more opportunities came your way. So it was a great experience for me there. I loved being a cop. I loved the people that I worked with. I think Maine has a different, relationship with law enforcement than a lot of the rest of the country does.
Oh, that's good. Like the people do.
Yeah. We're a very small town. Cops are, inherently, rule followers. It's in their nature to be rule followers versus maybe stretching things a little bit. So back in the 90s, it was wonderful being a being a cop, and just really community policing wasn't something that was new that you had to create a whole division for. You were doing it every day. The first agency I worked for had 4 full-time officers, including the police chief. You know, you knew everybody in town. You knew who the criminals were. You know, the criminals respected you. When they caught you, they usually confessed, right? There wasn't all, it was just this, it was almost like a game to them, right? So it was fun, and you did your best to make sure that, you know, everybody stayed online. But it was a good career, and I had a pretty eclectic police career. So, you know, I mentioned dispatch, did a little bit of corrections, got into patrol, rural patrol. So, you know, you might have, at one time I worked for a sheriff's department, you had 14 unorganized towns. You know, it may take you 20, 30 minutes to get from one side to the other running lights and sirens. It was a big territory. You end up.
Well, I'm just curious, like in those rural areas, like I've always wondered this, like what is the majority of the calls, like domestic dispute stuff? I would assume that's what it would be.
So, yeah.
But like generally.
Yeah, generally speaking, you got accidents, domestics.
Oh, yeah, true.
Right. And then, you know, a lot of times in the evenings, it would be burglaries. Right. Because you'd have people leaving work for the day and then come back, find their house broken into. So they'd be calling in. You know, you'd have these burglary sprees. But, you know, it was, you know, on the weekends, it was always bar fights. You know, like it's the normal stuff that happens. And then in between that, you might have some drug calls or something a little bit more exciting.
Tell us a crazy story. Like, what, you got to have some crazy stories.
You know, the one that's personal to me is getting dragged down a road by a drunk driver. Like that was a big catalyst.
Getting dragged down the road by a drunk driver.
Yeah, at the time I worked for a municipality and I was a supervisor, and we had gone to a bar fight one night, and you know, the team was inside and they're dealing with the bar fight and all, and they pretty much calmed it down. And they were outside and cruisers were blocking the street. So I was out there trying to move traffic around the block cars and all. And this guy was in this older van, panel van. And, you know, I'm trying to wave him by, and all he had to do was drive around the cruisers and gone by. I wasn't really looking for anything. And he's just sitting there and he's not moving. And I'm like, come on, let's go. And he's just kind of trying to yell to me about something. And you could just tell this guy was hammered. So sure. I walk up to the van and he's drunk. He's trying to tell me he's waiting for his cousin who was inside the bar to come out. And
he's like, I'm not leaving until I get my cousin.
You know,
idiot.
So, you know, it's one of those things where you're like, okay, put the car in park, and you can see that process in somebody's head, you know, that fight or flight. And you can see him processing, what am I going to do? And you're like, okay, he's going to try to take off now. So it was one of those, you know, vans that had the gear shift on the column. Yeah. So I reached in with my left hand, which was a mistake, and tried to put it into park. At the same time, it clicked to him that he was going to decide that he was going to leave. So he hit the gas before I could get it up from drive. So essentially, he starts taking off, and I'm hanging off the side of the van with my, you know, hand grabbing that column shifter, hoping that, you know, lovely piece of, you know, cast aluminum doesn't snap in half. Because if it does, I'm getting run over by this van. So
you're literally holding on to the shifter as he's stepping on the gas and he's dragging you down the street.
And I'm screaming at him, and you know, there's no running board, so you're not catching your feet, right? So you're trying to pick your feet up. So literally all the weight you're on that column shifter, and then of course your under your arm is resting on the open window portion, right? So you're squeezing your bicep and your torso together on that, trying to keep that, you know, because you know this column shifter, I've seen them break 1,000 times.
Totally.
They're not going to hold.
Just a little pin. Mostly.
So luckily enough for me, it wasn't a long section before he got to an intersecting street. You know, we're in a little downtown area, so he's got to slow down to make a turn. And I'm screaming at him. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, this is happening in nanoseconds, right? But it seemed forever. And I never got that from people who were talking about how life slows down and things slow down. It slows down, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
So luckily for me, the guys outside could hear me screaming, but they couldn't see me. And one of the guys, it dawned on him that I must be on this van. So as the van slowed down around the corner, he ran down the sidewalk and got to the van in time and flew open the passenger side door. And I got to tell you, it was just that hammer was about ready to drop. And as soon as I saw that door and Adam's face come in the window, he comes in and he starts jumping on the guy. And, you know, the thing tails off. And I think it ran across the sidewalk and hit a fire hydrant or a tree or something and stopped.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And then, of course, at that point, there's four or five guys there and you're just like, OK, I'm done. Like, I'm pretty well spent at this point. So I kind of stumble off the van. Yeah. And yeah, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, you get back to the station and I thought I was having a heart attack and ended up having the ambulance come down. But it's because all your nerves and everything get compressed under your underarm. So it kind of shuts down your system. You know, luckily, I didn't really have any long term injuries. And, you know, it's one of those things where you're hoping with every fiber of your body that this is a bad guy, right? You're trusting that this is just some habitual motor vehicle offender, some, you know, somebody who's just violent and what have you, and you're going to be able to put him away for years. End up just being, you know, a guy in the trades who didn't usually go out, went out one night with his cousin, had too much to drink, wasn't a bad guy, didn't have a terrible driver's history. And
that's
wild. You know, so it's, you know, he lost his license for some time. I think he did some jail time, but you know, the prosecutor's calling me and saying, what do you want to do? You know, you want to put him away. And I'm like, for as horrific as it was at the time, this isn't a bad guy. This isn't somebody who needs to go to jail for 3 to 5 years, right? Like this is just somebody who screwed up. And I'm sure he's taken a lot more from this whole interaction already than sending him to jail is going to do. That's not going to better him. Yeah. That's not going to change this guy.
Totally. It's the opposite. Potentially. Yeah.
And he owned up to it. Like there wasn't a trial. There was nothing. He got an attorney. They were just trying to negotiate to keep him out of jail. You know?
Yeah.
You know, and you sit there and go, he's already recognized the fact that he screwed up. What more do you really need? You don't really need to beat this guy down. You know,
that's so crazy though. But the guy almost killed you. You almost killed him. If it wasn't for your other officer partner saving at least one person's life, right? In that example, that's wild. And then it's just the after effects, like, hey, this is like a normal dude who just drank too much and just did a really stupid ass thing.
And there's a lot of people that end up in jail that, you know, do those things, you know, and it's just, it's one of those things, you know, I think for me, this was October 16th, if I remember correctly, 2000, which I'm pretty sure I remember correctly. You know, my oldest daughter was a year old. My wife's pregnant with our second daughter. And you start to realize, okay, this may not be the profession for me, right? Like this is great. Mm-hmm. I love it, but I don't know that I want to be doing this on a day-to-day basis, you know? And it took me probably another 5-6 years before I phased out. Where I probably, you know, I was at the station the other day and, you know, all the same guys are still there, you know, been promoted up and you're sitting yourself, that could have been me. Like you know, for not certain things happening, you could have easily stayed there for 30 years.
Yeah, totally.
You know, so
you didn't though. So what happened? So you moved on.
Yeah,
so, you're like, okay,
again,
that was a lot for me. This is a lot. I'm kind of, you know,
but I'm
young kids. I get it.
You know, and I guess maybe it goes back to that question you asked about high school. You know, I was always involved in things and, you know, I look back now, I've kind of have career ADD. So I'm always looking for the next thing, the next challenge, right? When I get to a point where it becomes the same old every day, there's no challenge. Two things I think about, right? So one is what's next for me? Like what's going to get me motivated? And two, have I brought the people up under me or next to me to a point where they should be taking over for me? Right. So you always have, for me, it's always two challenges, right? So now I got to get it out of the way for the next person to succeed like I have. So
that's awesome. That's great.
I've always kind of thought about those things. So for me, I was getting into accident reconstruction. You know, that started in 99, 2000. And that really developed a lot of skills. I started doing a lot of, you know, working with insurance companies at the time, started my own consulting company, started doing that on the side with them. And then that led me.
Like accident reconstruction consulting, like working with carriers, I assume, and helping them understand what's really going on from your time in the field. And then as an investigator, I assume.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't work cases that I would have any direct police involvement in. But, you know,
of course,
if there was a case in New Hampshire or Massachusetts or way up in northern Maine, you know, I would go up and investigate that accident for the carrier to, you know, determine who's at fault. You know, were there any mitigating circumstances? You know, were there issues with the vehicles, that kind of stuff? So, you know, get back to it brings everything back in that you talked about before, you know, like, you know, not really a mechanic, but, you know, I could look at a suspension system. I got my inspection, you know, certificate license for the state of Maine to be an inspection, you know, mechanic. You know, you can look at, you start to understand the mechanics of all that and then applying that knowledge, you know, to this process. And I got, you know, had a lot of success with that as a, I will say as a part-time basis being a consultant. And then that moved into, you know, an insurance company saying, hey, we've got this vacancy in special investigations, you know, with your background, we like your work. Would you like to come work with us? And you're like,
special investigations at a carrier. Right. That sounds pretty cool.
it makes it even better when they say it's Monday through Friday. Here's your car. You don't have to work nights, weekends, or holidays, you know, and we'll pay you more than what you're making now, including your overtime. So you're like, yeah, this is pretty easy sell. I'm going.
Yes. So yes, I will take that. Yes.
And there's a 401k and there's all these other. Yeah. Okay. I'll take it. And that started my career in insurance. So, you know, working workers' comp, pretty much. I started working workers' comp in Maine, then moved to personal lines. So we started doing, you know, auto thefts and fires and that kind of stuff. And then with my reconstruction background, they asked me to start working some of the, you know, risk pool stuff, a little bit more complicated things in Massachusetts and New York City. So I started working that stuff. And then
what does that mean? Like complicated risk pool stuff?
So,
like, I don't understand.
So like in Massachusetts, if you get assessed, almost penalized if you're at an at fault accident. So somebody would run in and they would hit, let's say, you know, one of those yellow barriers by an ATM and put a dent in the car. And then they would claim that it was a hit and run at a parking lot. Because if it's a hit and run, they don't get assessed, you know, this fine amount every year for X number of years. But if they're at fault, they do. So a lot of it was just looking at these low impact, what we call list claims, low impact claims, and determining. And it was always funny because you would get this one that was a perfectly cone shaped dent on the side of the car with yellow paint. And, you know, I'm like, I don't know a lot of canary yellow trucks out there that are going to do damage from 2 inches above the ground to, you know, 4 feet above. So I'm pretty sure this is safe to say it's a pole. And by the way, there's concrete dust. The gaps of the fender. So, but it was a lot of doing that kind of stuff. And then, you know, depending on the jurisdiction, you know, like you might have a law that says in one state, you know, if the person's inebriated or intoxicated, you have a limits of liability or that. So it was looking at a lot of that stuff as well. You know, and just seeing if there's, again, if there's comparing negligence, you know, between two drivers, is our driver 100% at fault? Are they 80%, 60%? Right. Something to negotiate the settlement on for our insured. You know, so it got into that. And then, you know, the company I was working for at the time, you know, with most companies, you can see this over time, you know, they grow, they shrink, they grow, they shrink. So we started losing people. They started expanding specialty line stuff. So I quickly found myself working, mid-market commercial lines. So I was working cell phone stores and convenience stores, a lot of them out west, like Texas area, New Mexico. They had a line where they wrote film equipment rentals in California. So we were doing a lot of that stuff. So it just kind of really, it fed into my need to always be doing something different. It was really a fun time for me because just as I started to get tired of something, something new came along.
So let's talk about that real quick. So like cell phone stores, all this camera equipment, like, you know, you're talking mid commercial. Like, what does that mean? Like, what were you doing? Like, what was going
on? So it depended on, you know, the company that was involved and the scams that were happening. So, you know, you might have.
So you're doing all fraud stuff.
It's all fraud stuff for the majority.
So it's not like, hey, like we had a fire here, whatever. You're doing like special investigations.
Yeah. If you had really massive losses, like you had a shopping mall that caught on fire, then, you know, you would be involved in that, but it wouldn't be so much from a fraud aspect. It would be kind of just helping out manage that large loss. You know, but for the most part, I would say 90% of it was all fraud related. And then you looked at the different scams. So like you might have convenience store scams or cell phone scams. Cell phone scams were good because you'd have alleged burglary there. And they would be claiming, you know, I lost $500,000 in stock, but they wouldn't have any records to back that up. Or they would claim that they were selling, you know, at the time eBay was really popular. I'm selling, you know, $250,000 worth of inventory a month on eBay. But they could never show you $250,000 of inventory that they had ever received in the life of the company. Right. So they would had these claims, legitimate claims, you know, it's a soft fraud thing, legitimate claims, which they then, you know, exaggerate to make it, you know, more. And a lot of people didn't understand at the time. You exaggerate one portion of this. You lie on your application. No, that kind of negates your whole claim. Like, you may have a legitimate loss, but now you lied to us. Now we don't have to pay you anything.
Hey, everyone. It's Kristen. I'm here to remind everyone that InsurTech Boston is back for 2024. We are going to be live at the House of Blues on May 7th. With the doors opening at 1 p.m. So no excuse, because you don't have to be there early. Tickets are available now at InsurTechBoston.com. Hope to see you there.
Oh, interesting. True.
Right.
So like, okay.
Yeah.
So if you can prove that they lied about any of it, you don't have to pay. Any of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's the theory of one part fraud, all fraud. So.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know that.
But
that's interesting.
But I will say a lot of companies don't go that way. Like, a lot of companies.
Yeah, they don't want to. It's not worth the battle. No,
they'll
right?
pay
yeah,
what they totally. Owe. They just don't want to pay more than they owe. You know, because.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, it's that relationship that you have with your policyholders, even though they've done something bad. Because it gets back to that, you know, that honest person who has a drink too much, right? Makes a bad decision, right? All they're thinking is, oh, I could really use an extra grand or an extra $1,500 to pay that rent, right? Are you really going to try to throw somebody in jail or penalize them for that? Or are you just going to pay the legitimate claim, you know, and just kind of say, don't do that again?
So like your drunk driver story, what's a crazy story, man? Like, tell us something that like, that's pretty wild out there that you've dealt with in the special investigation unit.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I got a lot more stories from the insurance side than I ever did from the police side. you know, some I've been directly involved in, some I haven't. You know, I worked cases in Mississippi, Louisiana that involved a particular, you know, homegrown organized crime ring. You know, they would repeat, you know, they'd have a vehicle, a truck hauling a trailer with a classic car or a couple of motorcycles in there, and it would get run off the road by a phantom car. Everything would catch on fire, burn. The problem is that they would reuse the same truck bin. You know, they'd haul these things out, dump them into the side of the road. You know, you'd start catching, I had this snap-on scanner that was inside the truck or the trailer or the garage fire, except they'd give you the same invoice for the same scanner every time. And then they would employ different people. So like, we had one where they claimed that lightning struck a metal building and blew it up, and the building itself was intact. It was blown out from the sides, but all the cars inside were totally demolished. And when I went to do the inspection, for a car to run and park inside a building, it needs to have an engine, wheels, and a transmission. And when that's lacking in the salvage burn that nobody has touched yet, and it doesn't have an engine or a transmission or tires, and there's no remnants of the steel belts around the tires, you kind of know that it was already a salvaged vehicle that was sitting in there. But these things were brand new, you know, fully restored, you know, worth $500,000 or what have you.
But that's just crazy. Like, but like, okay, like, can you like, but in that case, you're like, Are you kidding me right now? This thing has no motor in it. Motor's not going to burn up and fly out, you know, into heaven and go away.
But it's kind of that law of averages. They did it 1, 2, 3, 4 times. It never got caught. And then they would do it.
Jesus.
They would do it with my carrier. They would do it with another carrier. They would do it with another carrier. And when I finally got into this and started realizing and putting all the parties together and who the common denominators were, you know, you had bank employees, you had politicians involved in this, you had business owners.
Holy shit.
You had business owners employing their staff to get policies and do these things. They were repeating. The one that I loved the most was in that particular fire loss, there was supposed to be a restored 68 Black Camaro SS, RSSS. Beautiful car. It was the only photo they had submitted during the policy period for this one car. So the scam was, I'm going to get a policy of this one car, and then as soon as you approve it, I'm going to add 4 or 5 more cars on, but I'm not going to give you anything on those cars other than a VIN. And you're going to ask me for photos, titles on, but before I get to providing that to you, I'm going to have this big loss, right? So you end up on your side, don't have anything on these other cars. You don't have photographs. You don't have anything to go by, which is a great way to just take salvage cars, burn them up, and claim that they were brand new, right? You're not going to know the difference.
Yep.
So they provided this one photograph of this Camaro, and I got... friends, you know, you make friends with attorneys that are going to assist you. And this one attorney that I had working this case for a while, he happened to be, you know, on that side of Mississippi for like an arson conference he was speaking at. And he had a break and he's like, I'm just going to run over and try to do an interview with so-and-so and see, you know, what they have to say. And he shows up, guy's there. The other guy who had told me 2 days earlier that he didn't know this guy is working for this guy at this shop. Another guy that we know who's involved in this team and has had these other alleged frauds is there visiting. The attorney's like putting all the pieces together. So he goes to leave and he's like, oh, I just need to take a quick photograph, right? So I can document the date, time on my camera when I was here because I just don't have time to take notes. I got to get back to this conference. So he takes a photograph outside the windshield of his car and he leaves. He's not thinking anything about it. So we start chatting and everything else. And all of a sudden I'm getting a call at like 7 o'clock at night and he's all giddy. And I'm like, what's going on? And he's like, it didn't dawn on me. He sends me the photograph and there in the foreground of the photograph he took was this 68 Camaro, the one that was allegedly burnt out and all. It was identical and it had a very custom paint job. So you knew it was, he goes, it didn't dawn on me that was the same car. But here it is. He's got a photograph of it existing right then and there, that date and time, you know, 2, 3 weeks after this alleged loss. You know, the fun part with criminals is they're not very bright. You know, so you get to if.
Right. Like dumbass. Like, why would you even have that there?
Right.
Like, seriously, like, you know, but so, I guess they're just ramping up to do another to get away.
Hey, listen. And that's the thing is nothing's happening to us. You know, and this group is, you know, I think at the time I want to say they were somewhere around 60 million. I think that they had taken over the previous decade.
$60 million this group is taking.
Pretty much from every carrier out there, from large self-insured businesses. You know, they were doing everything from autos to properties, you know, property fires, water mitigation, remediation claims, you know, water leaks in houses, and, you know, you name it. They had the scams going and they were very successful. I mean, this was it. This was their business. They had legitimate businesses on the side, but I think those were just there to probably launder the money that they were making, you know, through some other means, but insurance fraud was absolutely funding that.
That's wild.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So what happened? These guys go to prison or what?
No.
Like what happened?
No, they're still operating. I flew down one day and met with the U.S. Attorney's office down there. I presented them, I don't know, a few thousand pages of documents, broke everything down, had, you know, link analysis charts showing who the players were, the claims involved, the money. We had pictures of the car. you know, that was supposedly the one that was involved in this. We had all this documentation. We had some, you know, public officials that were involved in this that were signing off on inspections and causes of loss
Wow.
Yeah, they signed a postal inspector who I know worked for it on a couple of years. And then I think that person got reassigned. And then, you know, this happened. This a U.S. attorney leaves and gets promoted. This one comes in. There's a political shift. And yeah, just goes away. Not sexy enough to prosecute. So what we're left with is a lot of companies still, you know, try to deal with this group who's continuing to be active because they know they're going to get paid.
But could people, I mean, obviously I get it. So it sounds like a lot of people's pockets are being padded. There's a lot there. I mean, $60 million is a lot of coin,
yep.
You know, so people are getting paid around this in order for these guys to continue to operate and do this, but it sounds like they're still operating today, but could they go to prison? Like, could you prosecute?
Yeah. If you could get somebody to prosecute them. But you know, so on the federal level, it tends to be, if it's not sexy enough, if it's not high enough dollar value, if it's not easy enough sometimes, and I don't want to paint that blanketly across because I know a lot of federal prosecutors and federal, you know, officers who do really good work and work really hard, and they put together some really convoluted high-end schemes. But if you're competing with somebody who's done a cyber theft, cyber ransom, you know, on a Fortune 500 company, or you've got somebody running a Ponzi scheme over here, do you really care about somebody who's done a bunch of auto theft scams, right? You're not worried about that.
It's wild.
So, you know, who's the victim in that place? Well, it's going to be me as a consumer from my insurance company whose premiums go up.
100%. 100% we're the victims of it. Yes.
But in their mind, but you're not affecting the, you know, the 100,000 people in this Ponzi scheme. Those are real victims. You're an ancillary victim, right? You're going to have to pay a little bit more on your premium, but you're not a real victim.
Yeah, you're just affecting the profits of the insurance companies. It's like, correct. But ultimately that affects us as consumers and how expensive our insurance is.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, the figure now is $308 billion annually in insurance fraud in the U.S.
$308 billion in fraud.
Yeah, you got about, in the U.S. You got about 100,000.
$308 billion? That's crazy, man. Holy shit.
Every single year.
Wow. I didn't know any of
this. Yeah, 1.5% of our GDP.
and that's not important enough, right?
It's not important enough. You know, it's 100.
But that's not, hold on. That's not to say that some of it isn't prosecuted, correct. To be fair.
Correct.
Right. But like the vast majority is not, I would assume.
That's correct.
Based on what I'm
saying. Yeah. You have to go individually. Now, I've worked with, you know, a prosecutor in Suffolk County, New York, who, you know, we took this former doctor/lawyer, you know, and got a conviction out of him for, you know, putting his car, driving his car purposely into a canal for the third time, you know, a $100,000 car, you know, and we had great video of that from a restaurant that they concocted to that, you know, and again, you know, they're not always thinking, people don't think about what's out there. Right. But, you know, so there are prosecutors out there that are willing to do the work and put this stuff in. But again, it's, you know, what we ran into a lot of time is like, you know, I'll keep using man because it's rural. You know, I go to a police officer who's got, you know, he's got a string of burglaries he's trying to investigate. He's got domestics. He's overworked with reports. Right. And then you're coming to him saying, I have this insurance fraud, and he doesn't know what that is. Nobody's ever explained him to it. He hasn't gone to school for it. He doesn't understand it, right? Doesn't know. I mean, before I got into this, I'd never read a policy in my life. You know, I had an auto insurance policy for 20 years and I'd never read through that thing. I didn't know what was in there other than it's supposed to be when I get in an accident, they're going to pay me back for my car, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to do a lot of education a lot of times when you get to the point where you think some of these things should be prosecuted. And then just hoping that you get somebody who will latch on to that and say, yeah, I'm willing to take the time to do it. So, I mean, it's definitely gotten better over the years.
Yeah.
You know, but unfortunately, you have these things where even if they are convicted, a lot of times they don't go to jail. Right. So what's the, you know, why stop?
You know, this is crazy, though. I mean, when I'm thinking about this, I think about like the people that are listening to this and whatnot. this is like the carriers would want justice around some of this. I mean, in the big stuff and whatever. And like you said, some of it, they don't want to fight the fight because it's not worth it. Although they're doing something wrong, it's like, you know, that's all this litigious stuff and spending all this money, these attorneys. And it's not, you know, this, I get all of that. But generally speaking, I mean, $300 billion. Like, I would assume that as an industry, I don't know, folks, let's invest 1% of that, right? In like a tiger team that goes around and takes down criminals that are literally organized crime around insurance fraud, because it affects all of our premiums personally, as well as our customers' premiums. Like, in a, that's a lot of dollars in fraud.
Yeah. And you know? And you do have regulations in place for that. So you got states like New Jersey and York, California, that tell insurers they have to have special investigations units or somebody overseeing it, or you have to have dedicated people for that. But it's not, that's great. I find this fraud, but then I have nobody to pass it on to.
You have special investigation group. Like, that's what you do. But then you have all these other people that are getting paid and don't, it's not worth my time because I got this big case that's going to put me in the newspapers, blah, 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 stuff.
Or you get like California, where you get the Department of Insurance that will take on a lot of these cases. But there again, you know, it's California. How many referrals are they getting every day? And how many investigators do they have to go out and try to finish the investigation for themselves, right? I find it by a preponderance of the evidence, right? It's more likely or not that it happened. We've got enough to deny the claim or whatever, but now they've got to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. I've got to prove 51%. They got to prove 98. They've got to go out and do their own interviews and do all this other stuff, right? True. So there's a lot more involved to that. And then they have to make a business decision too. So it becomes difficult. Excuse me.
So hate to put you on the spot, but what would you do to fix it? Like, give me any thoughts there. Like, how could you fix that?
It's not an easy fix. I mean, I think if it was an easy fix, we would have fixed it already, right?
Yeah, you know, totally.
I think it's a lot of work. I look at it now as we're in such an industrial revolution per se with data and AI and those things, you know.
Fair enough.
We have the ability to start utilizing that technology just like they utilize it against us to help us. So there's a lot of things that you can do on the front end of processes that no one ever sees that could really help shut things down. Now, the problem being, is that the best business decision to make? And I'll give you a for instance. I can put a script in your online form. And as you go to this online form to fill out for your policy, it's going to start telling me what device you're using to fill it out. Are you on a mobile device? Or are you on a laptop? Which mobile device? Is it an Apple? Is it Samsung? What model number is it? It can give me the ID number. It can tell me which carrier, if you're on a mobile device, that you're using from, what your time zone is, what your IP address is, and where that is, right? So I can look at those things. So if you're filling out this form and saying that you live in St. Louis, and yet you're using a carrier that's predominantly from Canada, let's say Bell or Rogers, right? Are you filling out an online form using a cell phone that's Lash Bell Rogers? Now I look at your IP address. Your IP address is coming back from, let's say, Spain or somewhere out. Are you using a VPN? Which we might be, right? You know, but these things don't make sense right now. So instead of fast tracking this policy and issuing a policy based upon the information put in, how about we just throw up a red flag? Right. We say somebody's got to make a call on this one. Somebody needs to verify these facts before we start moving on. You know, it's that type of technology. And this is a very simplified version, but this already exists. Then you could tie on. There's, you know, the finance industry has been great in cataloging and identifying, especially mobile phones that are associated to frauds on their side.
Like flagging them, like, hey, we know this phone has done shady stuff in the past. Basically.
So
that's interesting.
You have companies you have databases they've built that you can then add in and ping. So now when that device gets on that form, you can automatically ping it. And if it comes up as previously or suspected of being involved in scams, you just shut that policy down. You have to call a customer service representative, right? And then you get them.
Exactly. Yeah. It doesn't have to be nasty or anything. It's like, oh, you have to call customer service in order to get this done, basically. Yeah. That's right.
So, I mean, I think that's where technology is coming. There's a lot of technology, there's a company out there, I'm not going to name names, but there's a company out there that developed some technology for vetting, you know, essentially insurgents in Iraq and Afghanistan. We need these people to do translation services to work with us, but we need a fast way to determine whether or not they pose a threat. And they came up with this system. It's not voice analysis. I don't know the proprietary aspects of it, but essentially it allows you to have a conversation like we're having and tell you whether or not the questions they're answering are deceitful or not. And you can now employ that into a conversation that you're having when you're taking like an FNOL, first notice of loss, right? And you're asking questions. And if they keep getting like a green light or a thumbs up or whatever, okay, this seems to be a legitimate claim. But if you start seeing red or stops, then this is something where, okay, let's slow the process down a little. You could really speed up fast tracking good claims, slowing down questionable claims. So there's all this technology. There's, you know, there's another firm out there that can intercept attachments that are being sent by email to claims representatives, pull those attachments out, and within milliseconds tell you whether or not they've been altered or forged or how many versions of that exists. You know, so you're sending an invoice to your carrier and you've changed the invoice amount or the date on the invoice. And before the adjuster even gets that email to look at that attachment, there's already another email coming in or a flag in their system saying this appears to be an altered invoice, you know, and here's the original document. Here's what's been altered on it. You know, these technologies, they cost money to implement, right? So,
but hey, I'll just say, like, sounds like a really good business if there's $300 billion out there where this is happening and you can get on the front end of it. So what you're saying is like how you stop it, less about the back end. That's really complex, but we can do some things leveraging technology on the front end to kind of get in front of it and go, whoa, 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 this seems suspicious and maybe not write the business in the first place.
Right.
Because going back to your example that the dudes, you know, burning down the stuff with all the classic cars and whatnot, they're just running to another broker. You know, and that and going, hey, man, I'd love to get this policy. Can you help me out? And the broker's like, yeah, I'm so excited to get this new great customer. You know, oh, and they got this cherry 68 Camaro. That's awesome. Like, you know, and they write the policy and whatnot, and they're on to the next thing. But really, as they're inputting that information on the carrier site or whatever it may be, there could be some things that flag it out there in the universe and being like, hey, you know, this VIN on this Camaro has been salvaged 18 times,
right?
Kind of stuff.
Or,
you know?
Or that's not a VIN for a 66 Mustang, right?
Right. Totally.
You know?
Yeah.
So, and for me, it's about the fraud for me, but it's also about the business, right? So if I'm a carrier and I can implement these things where I make the underwriting process faster for good clients and I can process claims faster for good clients, I'm going to retain that client. I may go up a little bit in rates, but they're not going to shop around because they love my service, right? It's about the customer service aspect. On the fraud side, we just want to make it more difficult for the bad guys, right?
Yeah.
But by employing this technology, you can make it great for everyone across the board. You know, so I try to look at what technology is coming that we can put in place that's really going to benefit the company as a whole. But again, it gets back to how much are you going to invest? What are you going to invest in? Those are just a few examples of thousands of different programs that you could start implementing, you know, as a carrier.
Yeah.
So which ones do you use? Which ones give you the best ROI? Which ones are the best for customer service?
So Joe, what do you do now as chief digital, digital officer? I forget
digital
what it was.
Digital intelligence. Yeah. Director of digital intelligence.
Director of digital intelligence. There it is. Sorry.
So
what is that? What does that mean? What is your JOB?
Yeah. So over the years, you know, even in police work, it was understanding, you know, I'm in rural Maine. How do I access technical papers on, you know, the breaking force of a telephone pole? Right. I don't have the manual. I don't have a book. I don't have $100 to go and buy a textbook on it and then wait 3 weeks for it. I just had this accident yesterday. I got to get this report done. So I started learning how I could access this stuff, you know, using Google. And then, well, what other information is out there? And of course, I came in at the age of when, you know, I got to see the birth of all this, right? And you know, social media and all that. So I just started spending more and more time understanding online data. So now my job is, how do we how do we cull that data to allow carriers and law firms to use that to help them negotiate or stop fraud? How to access social media, what social media is best to access once I find it.
So, okay, give an example of that. I think I know where you're going to go with this, but like give an example, social media as an example, using okay. that. So I have a claim comes in.
Let's say it's suspicious, right? Let's say that, you know, I'm thinking this item wasn't stolen or they never owned the item or, you know, they got hurt and it wasn't, you know, associated to this or they're legitimately hurt, but I think they're malingering, right? So we'll go out and find your social media. We'll find information on your email accounts. We'll find programs that you're attached to, blogs that you've been on. Now find your Facebook account and look at your photographs. Do you have a TikTok? Do your kids have a TikTok? Do I see in the background? So your kids, you don't have a TikTok because you're 43, but your kids have a TikTok, right?
True. How'd you know my age?
I'm not saying I did any background on you, Reed, but you know, hey, listen, it goes both ways. But your kids have a TikTok and they're doing the new dance TikTok trend and they suck you into doing that with them on TikTok, right? And they post it up on their TikTok. So now here you are saying, I'm permanently impaired. I can barely get out of bed and I've got you on your kids' TikTok dancing, right? It kind of throws, you know, questions into the legitimacy of your claim at this point, right? Not saying that you don't have back pain and that you aren't hurt, but maybe it's not as bad as you're alleging it to be because you're looking for a bigger payout. So we can use that. And then video is becoming a really big thing now. We've got that shift from people actually posting and regurgitating, you know, things, as we call it, diarrhea with the fingers, right? I got to type out everything that I hear and see and think and feel. We're going to video. So how do we start dealing with that? How does an investigator or a claims adjuster find somebody TikTok? They want to be an influencer. They got 600 minutes of TikTok videos out there. They can't.
Yeah, totally. Like, how do you comb through all of that? Where's the meat in all of
right.
that? Yeah, that's a lot of work.
So that's right. where new technologies come through, new programs, especially AI, where I can run all those videos through a program. It will tag them all. So it will say, you know, this video is X number of minutes long. There's four people in it. Here's thumbnail photographs of each of these people. There's a vehicle in it. There's medical equipment in the background at frame such and such. They're outdoors. We see dancing. We see ATVs. We see the desert, right? It tags all these things. Gives you a transcript of the audio, right? That you can then do keyword searches in the audio. Do they say ambulance or accident? You know, so now what happens is you go from having to find the TikTok and then watch 600 minutes of it to I can create a summary on those 600 minutes. I can tell you there's four videos out of this that might have pictures of that piece of jewelry or that car, or there's a reference to an ambulance or a hospital or a doctor. Or, you know, there's other people here that we may match to a facial recognition library or something like that. You know, especially if you're working a ring, right? Well, why is this person who say they don't know that person? Like, I could have used that a few years ago. You say you don't know them, but then I go through and call all your photographs and download those from Facebook, and you're in 9 of those photographs on that person's Facebook page, right? For somebody you don't know, you're in it a lot. You know, so.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's looking at what we can do. And as, you know, as social media changes, you know, Facebook puts a lock on this or they stop letting you do that. Okay. You know, is Twitter the most popular social media platform anymore? Not really. You know, you got to go to TikTok.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, is TikTok popular with 50-year-olds? No, you got to go back to Facebook. Right. So you have to understand the demographics. You know, you have to understand, you know, our immigrant population, where are they coming from? What social media are they using?
True. Fair enough. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So if you're Chinese, you're probably on Weibo, you know, first, you know, new immigrants or first generation immigrants, you may be on Weibo or WeChat or something else. You might be using Douban, which is the TikTok variation, but the Chinese variation. So I might have to hit that website. If you're from India, you might be on the MOJ app. Which is TikTok-ish. You know, if you're Eastern European, Russian, you might be on VK, which is like Russian Facebook.
I've never heard of any of these.
Yeah. So you have to kind of, you really have to stay up on top of this stuff and know where your best ROI is going to be when you look at the person, right? Somebody who's 15, 16, 17, I'm not going to find them on Facebook, right? I might find references to them, but I'm not going to find them on Facebook. They're going to be on Instagram. So I got to go hit up Instagram. I got to go hit up Snapchat and try to find them out. Yeah, so that's my day-to-day is overseeing, trying to learn all this stuff, you know, working with my team to find the best way to find it and then store it, archive it, and then leverage it for, you know, our clients. And that's just the social media piece. Then we have medical canvassing. We got medical records retrieval. You know, we're always and we're implementing new AI tools there to summarize medical records to make it faster for, you know, our clients. So they're not spending days, weeks trying to get through 3,000 medical records. You know, they get these summaries, you know, that tell them essentially what the breakdown of the medical records are. You know, anything to speed up the process, right, is going to always be beneficial as long as it's accurate.
That's awesome, man. I mean, like, you know, as an officer, you know, you had probably a tape deck in the cruisers compared to where we are now with technology, and you've been all the way through it. Like, I bet, like, and I can tell you're really passionate about this stuff. You're really into it. I bet your head just spins with the tools that are available now to be able to go out and get this stuff. I mean, it's cool, man. Super cool.
I do a lot of teaching, and my thing used to be, you know, spend Sunday surfing. Right. Grab an hour or two and then just surf the web, do stuff, watch TikTok, watch YouTube videos. Right. You know, punch in a keyword, something that interests you and see what's out there. You know, YouTube has been just a great, you know, educational aspect if you can get through the lies that are perpetrated on there. Right. Listen, I was addicted to TikTok. Like, it was 2 hours before I went to bed every night. I finally had to turn it off. But every day, it's something new. Like, yesterday, it was, oh, my God. And like, there's 100 different programs out there that will transcribe videos now, right? That will take, if I'm trying to do a presentation and develop a new presentation for a class, I can just write out my thoughts or use ChatGPT to write me out an outline, take that outline, put it into this one. They'll generate slides for me for a presentation. And then I can take that, merge it, take the slides, take the outline, create a script on another AI tool, and then throw those into a fourth one that will take and build me a 20-minute video that I can then put on YouTube. Right? How crazy is that? So something that would have taken me a week and a half, 2 weeks to do, you know, 60 hours, I can do in an hour and 10 minutes, you know?
That's awesome.
Yeah. So it's just, it's amazing, but it is head spinning for sure. And, you know, I think sometimes I'm in this every day and then I'll go back and I'll talk to somebody in a carrier who's still doing stuff that I did 10 years ago. And I'm like, why aren't you using this? And they don't know. They didn't know it existed, just like I didn't know it existed until I watched TikTok. But they don't have time for TikTok, right? They're still working 90-hour weeks, you know, getting paid for 40. So
that's awesome, man. Wow. All that is just so fascinating to me. I had no idea it was that big. And I just keep coming back to, as an entrepreneur, like thinking about the opportunity to kind of disrupt that space in helping carriers, brokers, whatnot on the front end with all this technology that's available to us today. And that's what you're doing. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Really cool.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of smarter, more energetic people out there than I am. You know, I'm amazed at, you know, how people develop some of these tools, right? And how they're thinking to develop these tools. Like, you know, and you know what you know best, right? So you develop tools about what you know. But then I'm always in awe of, you know, this 22-year-old who just decides one day, hey, I think I can do this. They have no experience in it. There's nobody telling them. They haven't spent years, you know, trying to cultivate an expertise in it. They're just like, hey, I wonder if you can do this. And they do it. And then they go, well, I wonder how I can apply it to something in real life. You know, and then you end up going, yeah, you can. And you can apply it across multiple industries. Like, this is an amazing tool. Like, I can't believe that you came up with this on a whim. There's a lot of, I always tell people, I learn more, you know, in a month or 2 months or 3 months from people half my age than I can teach myself in 5 or 10 years. I work with a lot of young staff and they have taught me so much. Don't think because there you have a title or you have some position that you know everything, because you don't.
Yeah, totally.
You know, you need to be looking at these people who have an expertise and stuff. There's staff that work for me that, you know, before I even think about these things, they're coming to me. You know, when Threads first came out, I had one of my staff members, like, I hadn't even had time to really get into that platform, and they're emailing me telling me how I can access it on the web versus the mobile app and how I can access, find a profile on there and this and what this does and everything else. And I'm like, this is phenomenal, right? Like, you just saved me a whole day of searching and trying to plug this together. And when did they do it? After hours. You know, after they got done their work day, because they wanted to play around and because it interests them too. So,
well, that's true leadership though. Like, right there, that is the team being super engaged in what you're doing. And that comes from you, like, motivating them to do this. Fair enough.
You
got to take some credit, Joe.
Yeah, you know, a
little bit.
Listen, I will tell you, I was a micromanager at one point. I think one of the biggest problems with any, I don't care, public, private institution, there are very few that make managers and then train them how to be managers, right? We give you a manager title or a director's title or executive title, VP, whatever, and then never teach you how to do this process, right? It's more than just having some Myers-Briggs, you know, chart or a discharge telling you about your personalities. If the person doesn't know how to communicate, right?
That's so true.
Doesn't understand the process. Like, for me, I need to understand what my employees are doing. And I shouldn't say employees, my coworkers are doing, right? Mm-hmm. Because I can't make their lives better. I can't reduce these touch points that they're having. I can't get rid of their aggravations if I don't know what they do every day, right? So if I don't engage them, you know, on a weekly basis, say, what are your problems? What are you running into? How can I be helpful, right? What can I do for you? Should be the easiest statement to come out of anybody in a manager's position. What can I do for you today, right? Tell me what I can do to make, because if you're open to that, right? If you're listening to your employees, you're going to make yourself profitable. You're going to make yourself, you know, you just have the best team available. You know, you're
empowering them is how I would take that, you know, seriously.
You are, but you know, it doesn't always work with everybody, right?
That's true. Not everybody is a leader in that way or a manager of people in that way too.
And not all,
not everybody is like that.
And not all your people are receptive to that too, right? Like, and you have to understand those personalities too. Some people just want some direction and be left alone and they'll be fine. And you have to understand that. And again, I think that goes back to not really teaching you how to manage people. You're managing a system.
Yep.
You know, my thing is that 70-30 rule is imperative to understand. And we use it in hiring where I'm going to hire you because your knowledge, you have 70% of the knowledge for this position. And you'll learn the other 30%. I look at it differently. I'm hiring you because I want you to do. You have the capability of doing 70% of what I want you to do just like me. And I don't care about the other 30% because I'm never going to find somebody that's going to do 100% the way I do it, the way I want it to be done, the way I expect to be done. Because if I have that expectation, I become a micromanager. I want you to do it just like me 100% of the time. You're never going to reach it. So I'm always going to have my thumb on you.
That's so
you're going to hate me for it, right? But if I can find one person to do 70% of that, I've won. And, you know, and it makes their life easier. And then I will give them the tools to learn that other 30% or at least get close to it. But most of the time, I find that they do it better than me. So
that's awesome, man. So, hey, I want to go back to one thing. What advice? I mean, you've worked with a lot of young people. You've worked with a lot of people generally, and it seems like you've led a lot of people. What advice would you give to young entrepreneurs, startups, people kind of starting out in the game, if you will?
So I think one of the biggest things that I would say is don't get discouraged, right? Especially if you're in the insurance industry. If you're trying to sell something to the insurance industry, you're going to have, if it's good product, you're going to have this great embracing of the product. But don't set your expectations where you're going to sign a contract in a week or two. It may take you a year or two. There's several layers to get through, right? There's a buy-sell cycle. Don't get discouraged because it's going to take you 2 years to land a client or do something else, because that's just not possible in that typical environment. You'll realize your dreams, you know, but it's just going to take you some time to get there. You know, and on the reverse of that, you may have the best product in the world. It could be the coolest technology, but if it doesn't solve somebody's immediate problems, if it doesn't play well with their systems that they've already spent millions of dollars interacting with, you're never going to sell it. So think about the client from a perspective of what have they previously invested in for technologies? How does my tech or my product play into that? And how does it solve a fire that they're trying to put out today or in the very near future? Because if it solves a problem that they haven't experienced yet or haven't realized yet, it's not going to be on the forefront. They're not going to care about that.
That's good advice, man. I agree with you 100%. So you're so good about just breaking stuff down so simply, and it's so real, it's so true.
Thanks.
Seriously, I'm not kissing your ass. Like it's good, really, really good. And I totally agree. That's awesome. All right, a few more questions, sure. Then we're going to wrap it up. Well, one question I forgot to ask early on. You said you like cars. I know you're into cars. What's been your favorite car? What, you have a car that got away from you. Maybe you still have one, or maybe, you know, like what's been like, maybe the car in high school, like what's been a vehicle? I'll just say it could be a motorcycle too, where it's, you know, you're like, man, I let that one go, or I wish I would have had that, or my dad sold it or whatever.
So there are two, you're going to laugh at me on the second one. The very first car I bought when I think it was 14 and a half, 15 was a barn find. I paid $100 for it. It was a 1964 and a half Mustang, you know, so the first half year of production, they called them 65s, but it was 64 and a half.
Yep.
Hauled it home, put it on blocks, goes back to me not being a mechanic, right? And no YouTube at the time, right? So it sat there under a tarp that eventually ended up just, you know, fading away.
Disintegrating, yeah.
For 2 years until my father called a wrecker and had it, you know, towed away. This thing had everything. It had the seats. It was not in bad condition. You know, I think about it a lot now going, I could have, had YouTube been around, I could have restored this, right? or at least got it running. The second one is the first car that I ever had was an 82 Plymouth Champ. Two-door, stripped down, four on the floor, you know, the Dodge Omni, the cheaper version of the Dodge Omni Ford Escort, right? Like this thing, you know, it goes back to my parents not having a lot of money. We bought cars that were completely stripped down. They didn't even have radios. So, you know, but that was my first car, and I had a lot of fun with that thing. You know, it was one of those cars, front-wheel drive, but if you put it in reverse, you know, you could still drift with it, do donuts. I raced a lot of Dodge Omnis. A buddy of mine had a Dodge Omni, and I can remember racing across town at about 80 miles an hour after school one day on side streets and everything else. You know, luckily never got caught, didn't go to jail, and, you know, could have my police career after that. But I would love to have that car back. Absolutely love to have that car back. I don't even think there is one existing anymore anywhere.
All the Casper Clunker stuff, dude. A lot of that stuff's gone. Gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
especially that era.
Yeah. I think the closest you get now is probably an early 90s Dodge Colt, you know, was the eventual of that one. But that 82 Plymouth Champ, boy, if I could have that thing back, that would be I put it in a glass box on a turntable, you know.
Now I'm laughing at you.
Yeah, I know you are.
Everybody else is like Porsche 911, right? You know, I want a Ferrari F40, you know. No, I want an 82 Plymouth Champ.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. So, Joe, what do you do for fun these days? Outside of the kids and all that, and maybe grandkids at this point, what do you do for fun, man?
So I was lucky enough, you know, to acquire some family land up in Canada. So I've got some acreage up in Canada. It's off grid. And that's my that's my fun time now. So I got a tractor up there and a storage container and an RV. And, you know, I spend most of my time this time of year thinking about what I'm going to build up there, you know, a pole barn or, you know, what fields I'm going to clear. And then in the summertime, I get up there as much as I can so I can do that. So that's my fun. It's funny how it changes when you're, you know, in your 50s, getting closer to retirement.
It's, I will say that's probably one of my actual real favorite things to do. Like I have some property here at my house and I love just getting up early on a Saturday morning, smoking cigars and coffee and just roaming around the property and thinking about the stuff that I want to do in the future, you know? And like, you know, maybe it'll never happen, but I just love like envisioning like, what do we want to do here and there and with everything. Yeah. It's so cool, man. Yeah. That's awesome. And it sounds like you're going back to your childhood roots of playing in the streams and the woods and fishing and hunting and all that fun
stuff. Oh, for sure. You know, and you get out there and you're off grid, right? So, you know, you're collecting rainwater. I do have my Starlink so I can connect to the internet and still watch my TikTok. But you know, it's like, okay, I'm going to attack this field this year and I'm going to clean up all these rock walls. And then you start thinking about, you know, you got three, four, five generations of ancestors that were on this land before you
who
cleared this. Right. Who made these rock walls, you know, and you find an old wagon wheel, you know, rim or something else. You find the old blacksmith location that was there and, you know, you get some old square headed nails and that kind of stuff. And yeah, it's just
that's awesome.
I think as you get older, you think you start to reminisce a little bit more and romanticize the past. It would have been a really hard life for me to live without technology back then. But, you know.
That's awesome, man. All right, last question. What's your favorite drink, Joe? What do you like to drink?
Tequila.
And it doesn't have to be alcohol. Maybe you don't drink alcohol.
No.
More and more, I'm getting away from alcohol myself. And especially listening to this kind of stuff, man. You probably had a weird relationship with alcohol being a police officer.
Yeah, for sure. you know, beer has always been my choice. I like IPAs, but, you know, as I get older, they're not compatible with me anymore. But I like tequila. So a Paloma, I'll go for a Paloma or a Tequila Mule.
Nice.
But the difference is I like one, maybe two.
Okay.
That's where you call the limit. Right. And it's, you know, maybe on the weekend, maybe one evening, but it doesn't have to be every day.
That's great, man. That's awesome. That's awesome. All right. Well, next time I see you, we'll have a Paloma together.
Sounds
good. Maybe we'll do a couple of shots too. We'll see. See if I can convince you.
Get a little Patron Silver. Yeah.
There you go. Hey, Joe, this was awesome, man. Man, just fascinating stuff. And thank you for joining the show. It's really cool. Listeners are really going to enjoy it. It was a lot of good context. And you lived a great life and are doing some really cool things in our industry. So thanks for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Reed, for having me. And I really appreciate those words. It's been a good life. I got no complaints.
That's awesome, man. All right. Well, thanks again.
All right. We're back. Joe Stevenson. What'd you think, Kristen?
From the time that the request came in, I knew this was one that was going to be interesting and different than our typical ones. I don't know. I always love listening to people that have stories from being in law enforcement and then having it transition into something that's connected to our day-to-day of insurance. I don't know. It was good. It was entertaining.
Yeah. I'm just going to say, like, you know this, like, I loved this dude. It was so fun, like, getting to know him. Such a good dude. Like, I know I say that about everybody. I get it. But no, he just is. He really is. And I just really, like, one, I just really love the dude's energy and just how he is, like, as a leader. I mean, what, all of it. But, like, I loved hearing all the stories, not even necessarily from the law enforcement stuff. Like, that stuff was really interesting. But all of the fraud stories. And there was, by the way, folks, there was a bunch that he didn't put on the air there that he shared with me. Crazy stuff. Like, people, you know, videoing with stolen camera equipment for treason purposes, like wild stories. But I'll say, like, for me, the thing that was most fascinating about this whole thing was the $308 billion
with a
in
B.
fraud. With the B. And so, like, I'll say that again, $308 billion in fraud in this country. Think about that. For all you startups that are listening, right, people that are looking for ideas and things, you start to talk about, you know, like, think about what Joe was talking about and how they're using modern tools and technology to go through and just go all deep into the web and find out all this information. If you can impact that market a tiny bit, it's huge, huge, huge money, and everybody's happy. And what's, and the thing that, like, and I really didn't know a lot about this prior to getting into this with Joe, but knowing now that, like, and hey, maybe somebody will get mad about this. Good, go do something about it. That nobody gets prosecuted around this stuff.
Yeah,
it's like nobody really cares. And then, so then, how do you impact it? You impact it through technology. You impact it through, like, some of the stuff that he's talking about. Like,
it's simple technology too, though. You know, some of the things that he was talking about. So if they're not going to be prosecuted after they do it, so how do we prevent it from happening? And things like simple things that carriers and agents could do. And I think one of the things he talked about was, you know, if someone's filling out, you know, a form for personal lines, you know, on your website, check where the IP is coming from. And if it's outside of a state or health, it's outside the country that you're looking to write business, then it should red flag that you're not going to, you know, even give them the information. Just small little things that people could be thinking about, you know, to prevent it, knowing that the ability for it to be prosecuted on the other end is very small.
It's crazy too, because, you know, like, if you think about it through the agent's lens, it's like, oh, I just got this great prospect that owns all these convenience stores. It's awesome. You know, and they're like, I'm writing this deal. And it's like gnarly, you know? I mean, and then they would say, like, oh, you know, as a field underwriter, as the agent, then, like, you should kind of, like, blah, blah, blah. Whatever. Like, these guys are pros, literally. Yeah. And they're doing it over and over and over and over again. And it's like, what kind of tools and things? I mean, that's a really simple one you just mentioned, Kristen, but what kinds of tools and things can we build as an industry to prevent this?
Yeah.
You know, people are screaming about how expensive insurance is, right?
Yeah.
Impact the fraud. What does that do for everyone? It's massive, massive. But it was just really, really fascinating one for me. Really cool. And I just love talking to Joe. He's a good dude. You know, I'd love to have a beer with that guy.
I do
no
kind
doubt.
Of, you know, one of the things that I thought was interesting about, you know, what he's doing now, and he talked about social media. We always hear about the bad of social media. And he said, you know, the further you go, the weirder and more interesting things. But the things that he's being able to learn by going on to these social media sites and to help with insurance fraud was interesting. So I guess it's one valuable thing that social media is doing.
Yeah, true. People are going to get smart, though, smarter and smarter and smarter. But I love what he said about, like, the TikTok stuff. Such a good example. It's like, so totally makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, like, whatever it was, their you know, brother, sister's cousin's friend is doing a TikTok and they're in the background, yeah, like doing it. Like, it's pretty cool, you know? But yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. And yeah, I'd love to have Joe back at some point. Kind of give us some more stories and things and, you know, ideas on how to really truly impact this across the industry in the future. And hey, you know, we should start prosecuting people, but apparently everybody's on the take, you know, and nobody really cares because, hey, they're going after the big giant cyber stuff and, you know, container ships full of kilos of cocaine, I guess. Stuff's not that interesting. Although everybody in this country is paying more in insurance. Right? Carriers aren't making as much.
Yeah.
The commissions are going down. It's not good for anyone. No one. It's good for the guys that are doing the fraud, I guess.
Yeah. It just that number is crazy to me. But I love that this one, it's a new topic, right? We haven't really taken on fraud, and probably for that reason that it's still something that needs to be have a light shined on it, because it is a big problem. You know, bigger than many of the topics that we've taken on about like better distribution and things like that. So
absolutely impact that at a carrier.
Yeah.
Gee, you know, in a material way, that is real bottom line. Yeah. That's what's just fascinating. It's like a whole new kind of world for me, with that. So yeah. It was great. I had a lot of fun with this one. It was good.
Same.
Well, all right. Well, more to come. Much more to come. All right. Stay tuned, everyone.
The Insurance Technology Podcast is a production of Ivins. Visit InsureTechPod.com to contact us, suggest a topic or guest for an upcoming show, and subscribe to be notified when our latest podcast is available. You can find all our episodes in your favorite podcast app. It's where you can also leave us a rating and a review that helps other people find the show. Thanks for listening.